It's Elise here, back with episode 5, part 2. Thank you so much if you're listening again, and welcome if you're a new listener. Today I'm going to be talking about 3 more locations that have some great stories with them, and again, I'm including a famous non-Canadian bonus location. As usual, I've chosen locations that you can visit. All but one of the houses I'm talking about today are open to the public in some capacity. So today I'll be covering Point Ellis House, Bebbin House, Fair Acres Mansion, and the bonus location is the Myrtles Plantation in Louisiana. I want to give a quick shout out to Kelly, the executive director at Point Ellis House. She got back to me and we chatted a little bit. She's great, so thank you so much, Kelly, for helping me out. Just like the stories in part one, these houses have been preserved to amazing detail and involve, in some cases more than others, original detail and items from the original owners. You're going to hear about the ghostly tour guide, a ghostly child still looking for someone to play with, a house with a very dark and twisty history, and the controversial ghosts at the Myrtles Plantation. As always, to see photos and articles that helped me in my research, as well as locations and tour information, please head over to realscarypodcast.ca for the episode 5, part 2 blog. So without further ado, let's get started. The first property is the Point Ellis House in, you guessed it, Victoria, BC. We're keeping on theme from the last time. The O'Reilly family actually owned and lived in the home for over 100 years. Peter O'Reilly was born in England in 1827, and after serving as a police constable for nearly 10 years, he decided to look for new opportunities in British Columbia. He arrived in Victoria in 1859, where officials with an understanding of British law were needed to help as the gold rush was well underway. He was soon appointed gold commissioner, judge, and sheriff for the colony of British Columbia. In 1863, he married his wife Caroline, and the family became very highly regarded in the community. Peter and Caroline moved to Point Ellis House in 1867 and proceeded to have 4 children: Charlotte, known as Kathleen, Francis, Mary, and Arthur, known as Jack. Jack and his wife ended up living in the home until they passed away, and their son John and his wife moved into the house. It was John and Inez who saved the home from destruction and restored it back to its former glory, eventually selling the home and its contents to the province. The O'Reilly family took great pride in their gardens. They were designed to accentuate the home, and Peter and his daughter Kathleen were especially passionate about them. You could find vegetables, cut flowers, small fruit orchard, and a greenhouse. The gardens and surrounding nature is well regarded as one of the largest surviving heritage landscapes. It's still a pride of the province long after the O'Reillys have gone. In 1975, when John and Inez sold the home, they left almost everything behind. They realized the family's possessions were part of the amazing history. So when visitors go to Point Ellis House, you're seeing all of the family's possessions, which I'm sure also helps in facilitating the paranormal activity. There have been many, many stories at Point Ellis House, and it's not uncommon to see the full-bodied apparition of family members. In the 1960s, 2 women were traveling from overseas and were scouting out some tourist spots. They found a beautiful spot to rest for the night, next to the water and on the grounds of the Point Ellis House. They drifted off to sleep in their sleeping bags and were awoken later by a woman ordering them off the property. They quickly began to pick up their belongings to leave and then realized they were alone. They tried to fall back asleep but just couldn't shake the feeling of disapproval. Inez O'Reilly believed that this was most likely Caroline, who didn't appreciate people camping on her property. In the 1970s, a group of tourists arrived to the home for a tour. Inez was up on the ladder painting some trim and told them to go in, she'd be in shortly. Before she knew it, the tourists were coming back out of the house and Inez was mortified. She had actually completely forgotten about them. She invited them to go back inside for the tour and apologized profusely. The guests, however, were quite satisfied with the visit, telling her the nice young lady in the blue dress had shown them around the house already. Inez was confused and asked if they could bring her to the young woman. She followed them inside, and though the young woman was nowhere to be found, the visitors were retelling her the tour. They explain the history of the house that she was even unaware of, or even some things that she doesn't really bring up in tours. So how did they know all of this? They went into the former bedroom of Kathleen O'Reilly, and one of the visitors exclaimed, "That's the dress. That's the dress that that girl was wearing," pointing to the dress that had once belonged to Kathleen. The other visitors came in and conferred, "Yes, that's the dress." Inez had just placed the dress on the bed as a display. It seemed that Kathleen was back. There was no doubt that Kathleen loved her home at Point Ellis, and obviously she decided to help out her niece that day. Another family member that likes to pop in occasionally is Frank O'Reilly. In the 1980s, a tour guide was closing up the house for the day and went into Frank's room to turn off the light. As she was closing the door, she heard a man's voice, but of course, the hallway was empty. She believed that this was Frank. There's another element to the Point Ellis home, and that is the Point Ellis Bridge. On May 26, 1896, Victorians gathered to celebrate Queen Victoria's birthday. Consolidated Electric Railway Company, streetcar number 16, was crossing the Point Ellis Bridge. There were 143 people packed onto the car, headed to view the mock naval battle that happened annually as part of the festivities. Just before 2 p.m. that day, the poorly maintained bridge gave out, and the crowded car fell into the water below. 55 people died that day. The streetcar was pulled onto shore just adjacent to the Point Ellis house, and Peter O'Reilly wrote about it in his journal the next day. "Very bright sunshine, but a day of mourning. Four divers still engaged in the endeavor to recover the bodies from the wreck yesterday. Vast crowds surrounded the fateful spot, boat launches, steamers, and a very large derrick constantly at work. 49 bodies taken out upon the present." What he didn't detail was the fact that many of the bodies were laid out upon their own lawn and those of their neighbors, which would have been very disturbing to top it all off. Now, apparently for some time, the O'Reillys actually thought that Kathleen was on or near the bridge at the time, and they were quite distraught that she was one of the victims that day. I'll have more about the Point Ellis Bridge disaster on the blog. So not only is water believed to be a conduit for paranormal activity, but this body of water saw a substantial loss of life, and I have no doubt that some of these poor souls are probably still in the area. Many people have also reported seeing a red light passing back and forth underneath the bridge. However, the light has no source. People believe that this is a search party, forever looking for more victims. Prepare yourselves, everyone. This next house is not in Victoria. I know. This podcast is all about growth, though, so let's leave our little comfort zone of Victoria behind, and we're going to head to Nanaimo, BC, where we'll find Bebbin House. This is also the only house out of the bunch that I believe is not open to the public. It's right near or on, however, a public park, so you can see the exterior of the home, but that's about it. Though after you hear what's happened there, maybe you'll be okay just looking from the outside. Frank Bebbin was a timber baron and built this house in 1930 on his 160 acres of rolling land just north of Nanaimo. This property was sold to the city in 1953, shortly after Frank's passing, for use as a park, and eventually the building became home and headquarters to Nanaimo Tourism in 1997. Before this, the main floor served as a daycare, and the operator often heard stories from the preschoolers about a child in funny clothing playing with a red rubber ball. The invisible playfellow was often subject of their drawings as well, and the daycare director was very taken with the similarity between children's drawings. It's thought that the child was the son of a cook who was a Chinese woman, and he came with her to work at times, and it's believed that he died in the home. There's not a lot about how he could have died or who exactly he was, but this is the belief. Furthermore, people claim to also hear the sound of a thick rubber ball bouncing down the stairs or in the hall, only to find nothing upon inspection. Phantom footsteps, drops in temperature, and a glow coming from the master bedroom on the second floor are common things that people have reported. People have driven past the home at night to see the glowing light that I mentioned, as if there's a light on in one of the rooms. Only upon inspection the next day, there's no light that has been left on. There's a supposed room near the boiler room that people have said was the servants' quarters. Now, when researching, there are some other articles that say this family didn't have a fleet of servants. So they had one cook, and as I mentioned, her son, who was not a servant but just accompanied his mother to work on some days. This was relatively common at the time, so I'm not convinced that this room was sleeping quarters, but maybe more of just a storage area. A psychic at one point, whose child attended the daycare in the building, took a tour one day and became very, very upset when she came to, quote-unquote, the servants' room. She felt as if she couldn't breathe and just never, never wanted to be near the basement again. There are also reports of strange phone calls. In 2001, a staff member checked her voicemail in the morning to find that she had a message from 11:20 p.m. the night before. When she listened, there was nothing but the sound of someone walking heavily across the floor. The stomping sounded oddly familiar, and she couldn't help but feel like the call came from inside the house. Moreover, there have been many instances where the apparition of women are seen walking through the halls out of the corner of your eye. Sounds of teacups tinkling and light chatter coming from the upper floor. Items will also go missing quite frequently, and the doors in the home will lock or open on their own. Nanaimo Tourism is not currently housed at Bevan House anymore. It's supposedly still rented out as the office space, but I haven't been able to track down exactly who the current tenants are. The last Canadian place I'm going to talk about is the Fair Acres Mansion. It currently houses the Burnaby Art Gallery and is also home to many paranormal experiences. Once you hear the almost unbelievable background of this home, you're going to be shocked that there aren't more things going on here. Henry Kepperly moved to Burnaby in 1909 and wanted to find a picturesque location to retire with his wife Grace. They had a stunning 32-room mansion built on the shore of Deer Lake. This home featured a billiard room, a dining room, crystal chandeliers, a massive porch, and it was all set overlooking their stunning grounds. Grace loved her gardens and spent most of her time outdoors. She also cherished children and adored her stepchildren and grandchildren. She was also a philanthropist by nature, often supporting youth-related causes. So when Grace died in 1917, she was the sole heir, actually, of their home. She had willed it to Henry, who sold it in 1920 and moved to California. This, however, was not exactly in line with Grace's final wishes. She had specified in her will that upon the sale of the home, Henry would use the proceeds to construct a playground in Stanley Park. He didn't do this. Not right away. The money was eventually donated once Henry passed away in 1929 and did go toward the creation of the Kepperly Park Playground in Stanley Park. The home changed hands then a couple of times as private residences to a couple of families and was even used as an annex for tuberculosis patients alongside the Vancouver General Hospital. The home was then sold to the Order of St. Benedict in 1939. During this time, the house was a peaceful monastery, providing a beautiful sanctuary to the order's monks until the Westminster Abbey was completed. Now, when the monks moved on, this is where the mansion's history gets a little dark and twisty. Well, actually, a lot dark and twisty. In 1955, a religious cult known as the Canadian Temple of the More Abundant Life moved in. They were headed up by William F. Woolsey, who insisted his followers call him Archbishop John I. It turned out that Woolsey was actually wanted across the U.S. on multiple charges including bigamy, child abandonment, extortion, and assault. The cult was housed in the massive and stunning mansion, but they also opened a school for children as well, where unthinkable abuses occurred daily. Woolsey was unyielding when it came to the punishment of the poor little kids that went there. Many were traumatized by abuses ranging from physical beatings, sexual and emotional abuse, but also the curriculum itself. Apparently, Archbishop John warned the children that they would die if they didn't adhere to the teachings or if they left and went to public school. This continued until 1960, when he was outed by a tell-all article that appeared in the Vancouver Sun. After this, he fled again, but was brought back to the U.S. to stand trial, leaving behind a lot of pain, anguish, sadness, broken families, and unanswered questions. Now, it came out in newspaper articles, like one that I'll link in the blog, actually, that outlines everything, including his bogus degrees and honors, which were most likely purchased from a diploma mill. There were no records of his consecration. Furthermore, a Roman Catholic spokesperson reiterated that the Pope did not recognize Wolsey's sacred orders, quote unquote. Interestingly, it's not that easy to find information on Wolsey. You would think that with all of this history and everything that went on, that there would be a lot more stories out there and information, but there really isn't. And I find that strange. I'm getting conspiracy vibes from this one, but I can't be sure. Once the monster, who was William Wolsey, was out of the mansion, it became a fraternity for a while, and many students complained of not being able to sleep due to paranormal activity. Following the abuses seen in that house, the abuse from the fraternity was more physical to the house itself. A fire was set in the once immaculate billiard room. Walls were spray painted on the interior and exterior, and the city of Burnaby took the home back in 1966. They renovated it for use as the Burnaby Art Gallery. During renovation, it's widely accepted that this can increase paranormal activity, and this is exactly what happened. While there had been subtle reports during the fraternity's use, the activity increased substantially in the years that have followed. There are many reports of seeing a woman in a flowing white, old-fashioned dress. People have seen her walking through the gallery only to disappear into a wall. People also often feel strong emotions attached to her personality. Usually peace and tranquility, but sometimes extreme sadness. Some staff have also reported feeling like someone's following them, only to hear a rustle behind them, like that of someone wearing a full skirt and turning quickly. This apparition is believed to be Grace Kepperly, and many hypothesize that she could have been drawn back here to calm the children's energies that are left behind. Now, the experience with the children seems to emanate from the third floor, where Wolsey apparently would lock them in the dark as punishment. I'm sure much worse happened, but I don't even want to explore that. Children can be heard crying from the now unused third floor. Footsteps and scraping is also heard quite often. A little girl has been seen skipping across the lawn from time to time. A mischievous ghost is cited as residing or maybe just frequenting the basement. And perhaps because of the playful nature, this is one of the children that used to live in the home. A worker was disassembling paintings from their frames one night and kept turning to grab his tools, and they would be back hanging on the wall. This happened multiple times, and when he left to place the frames in storage, the door was locked when he came back, and he noted that the padlock was swinging as if someone had just put it on. There are many, many more things to happen in the house that include the sounds of people talking, screaming and laughing, footsteps, thuds and bangs, doors opening, closing, and locking on their own, apparitions of a monk on the stairs, a well-dressed man in the gallery and at the top of a staircase, dark shadows, and strange light anomalies. As I said, the Fairacres Mansion is open to the public as it is home to the Burnaby Art Gallery. I didn't hear back from them, but I'm assuming they don't do haunted tours. Though they should. I think it would be really interesting, and especially the history. But you can still check out the house, and maybe you'll experience something for yourself. Lastly, I'm bringing you a bonus location, and just like in part one of this episode, this is a non-Canadian location. I'm going to tell you about the Myrtles Plantation in Louisiana. This is another very, very famous location, just like Villisca, but also it's known worldwide for its haunted grounds. The plantation began with a man named General David Bradford, otherwise known as Whiskey Dave. In 1796, yes, that's right, 1796, he fled the United States for fear of imprisonment for his role in the Pennsylvania Whiskey Rebellion. This was an uprising from the whiskey tax imposed by the U.S. government to pay for war debt. He arrived at the Bayou Sara, which at the time was a Spanish colony. He acquired a parcel of land that was about 650 acres where the Myrtles plantation was built. When Bradford was eventually pardoned in 1799, he moved his wife and children to the plantation. Bradford died in 1808, and his wife Elizabeth maintained management of the home until 1817, when she turned it over to her son-in-law Clark Woodruff. It's with this branch of the story that we get the most famous legend, and much of it is debated. That's why I said these ghosts are very controversial. It's really unknown how much has been twisted over time and which parts are rooted in truth, which have been made up over time, and so from now on I'm just going to refer to it as the legend. This is the legend of Chloe. Chloe was supposedly a slave owned by the Woodruffs, and one version of the story is that she became Clark's mistress, most likely by force. This was a very common thing to happen in those days, number one, for people to have slaves and also for slaves to be mistresses to their masters. The other version is that she had been caught listening in on Woodruff's business dealings, and that she had her ear cut off as punishment, so she began wearing a green turban to cover this. Next, Chloe supposedly poisoned the family, and her motives, again, are a source of debate with people depending on which previous storyline they believe. It could have been revenge, or an attempt to win favor with the family by making them sick and then nursing them back to health. However, the plan backfired when Sarah and her two daughters ate this cake that was poisoned with oleander and died. This part of the story has actually been proven to be incorrect, as they actually passed away from yellow fever. The last part of the legend is that other slaves weighted her down, threw her into the Mississippi as punishment or to escape punishment for harboring her. One of the main counters to this whole story is that Woodruffs didn't have a documented slave named Chloe. To me, honestly though, that's not much in the way of evidence. She could have been undocumented, her name could have been changed, there's a lot of factors that could come into play here. And honestly, speaking from a little bit of experience, my four times great-grandfather on my mom's side came to America on a slave ship and was a slave for a portion of time. And in doing my family's genealogy, honestly, I found it really hard to find slave records. If they weren't destroyed, they're usually just not out there publicly. This isn't something that people really want others to know about. It's definitely a stain on people's histories. And names were also actually changed quite often. For example, his nickname was Strong Arm. So upon his freedom, his last name was actually documented as Armstrong, and that's a family name now. Anyway, enough about my family history. I just wanted to show that just because there's no documentation, that doesn't mean that this person didn't exist. Regardless of the evidence and counter-evidence, it doesn't change the numerous reports over the years of a black woman seen in a green turban, on the grounds, and even in photographs. That's right. One of the most famous and compelling pieces of paranormal evidence of anywhere comes from a photo of the Myrtles plantation. I'm going to obviously have links of the photo on the episode 5 part 2 blog. The photo shows an apparition standing between two buildings of the mansion. The shadowed figure is not solid, and the boards of the house can be seen through the form. A researcher by the name of Norman Benoit was given permission to investigate the postcard. He concluded that the measurements of the figure were suggestive of a human. No one has been able to prove that the photo is anything but authentic. There's another photo that shows a young girl in the background window wearing an antebellum style clothing. So I'll link that one as well. It's really amazing. You can see the detail captured. It was a photo taken by a guest who didn't even notice until later, and there's no indication that the photo was faked. A previous owner talks about being awoken in the night by a woman hovering over her, fitting the description of Chloe. Yet another one of the owners talked about the time that she realized that Chloe was a guardian of the property and people. One day she was working in her office and heard a raspy voice saying, "Check your baby." She didn't think much of it, just brushing it off as exhaustion. Maybe she just overheard a guest talking nearby. She knew her 10-month-old was sleeping in the nearby room. Again, the voice said, "Check your baby." So she went to his room and he was gone. She ran around yelling his name, and as she got to the front door, looking outside in the courtyard, she saw her son teetering near the edge of the pond. She was thankfully able to get him inside in time, and he was okay. Despite many of the rumors that up to 10 people were murdered in the home, only one was ever documented. His name was William Drew Winter. After the Woodruffs, the home was sold to Ruffin Gray Sterling and his wife Mary Catherine Cobb in 1834. They remodeled the home, doubling it in size. And it was actually with the Sterlings that the plantation got its name Myrtles, after the crepe myrtles that grew on the grounds. Eventually, Mary would give the plantation to her daughter Sarah and her husband William Drew Winter in 1865. In 1871, William was killed on the porch by an unknown man. There have been some speculations, but no one was ever confirmed as the shooter. Supposedly, he staggered in the home and up to the 17th step on the stairs, trying to get his wife. He collapsed on the step and died. People say they can hear the footsteps going up the stairs, and supposedly they stop on that step exactly. Now, there may not have been murders on the property, but most certainly in all of this time there have been deaths. People didn't really go to the hospital. Most people did die in their homes or on their property. So I'm sure there have been many deaths over the years. Take the original Bradford family. Mother Sarah passed away from yellow fever, and most likely she did die in her home. The Winters lost their 3-year-old daughter to typhoid, and again, she most likely passed away in the home. There's also a very famous mirror in the home, and as you'll recall from the Villisca Axe murder house, I talked about the custom of covering mirrors when people pass away for fear of souls becoming trapped in the mirror. Now, this mirror is a very famous piece of the Myrtles plantation. People have seen handprints and faces appear in the mirror. There are quite a few photos of strange phenomena around this mirror as well. People believe that it's Sarah Bradford and her 2 children that are trapped inside. So as you can hear, there's a lot going on here. A lot of legend, probably some truth, and probably even more that people realize. So the full roster of things that have been known to happen are distant cries of babies, beds moving and levitating, apparitions of little girls seen around the grounds, and she also shows up in photos, apparition of the slave woman, shaking and rattling chandeliers, phantom voices, perfume smells with no explanation, sounds of a party happening, and I'm sure many more experiences. Pretty much everyone, however, says that the spirits at the Myrtles plantation are friendly and quite benign. Right now, the Myrtles plantation is open as a bed and breakfast, and they do offer day tours. All of this will be up on the blog. If you ever find yourself in Louisiana and you want to visit the Myrtles Plantation. This brings me to the end of this episode. I hope you've enjoyed exploring these historical homes with me. Hit that subscribe button and that like button to show me some love. And as always, keep in touch with my social media accounts for updates. Both Instagram and Facebook can be found at Real Scary Podcast. If you have visited any of these places and have your own stories, please let me know via my email, realscarypodcast@gmail.com, and don't forget to check out the blog post for episode 5, part 2. As always, you can find this on my website, realscarypodcast.ca, and click on the heading episodes. So in the blog post, there will be photos and extras of all of these places. I'm always updating any tour information on my website under the heading maps and tours, so make sure you check that out as well. If you would like to win some Real Scary merch, please head over to my Facebook page. Make sure that you like my page, not the post. I have another t-shirt up for grabs. Congratulations to the last winner, Brianne Marie Photo. Yay, good for you. So please find the contest post. It's there that you're going to just tag 2 friends that you think will like this podcast. And that's it. That's all you have to do. Good luck. I hope you'll join me for the next episode. Episode 6 is sort of the last episode for BC. It's going to be a mix of a few different things. So until next time, this is your friendly neighborhood host, Elise.